everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside scoop on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can find us at restaurantguysradio.com, the Heritage Radio Network, and of course, you can always download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing really well.
Glad to hear it.
I had a really cool experience the other day, and I talked to you about it actually at the time, but I wanted to kind of share it with our listeners because it's one of those moments in life that I just think is really interesting.
Go ahead.
I was in my kitchen, and I had a Mexican Coke with dinner.
Yeah.
And there was about 4 ounces left in the bottle that was sitting on the counter.
Yep.
And a couple hours later, I went back and had the last 4 ounces of that Mexican Coke. For those of you who don't listen all the time, is Coca-Cola still made with sugar, with cane sugar, instead of with corn syrup. And I just think it tastes much better than regular Coke. Anyway, I'm not a huge soda drinker, but with pizza, I got to have Coca-Cola. It's
okay.
Just one of my combinations I got to have.
Okay.
So I'm in my kitchen. And as I'm drinking that last 4 ounces of Coke that's been sitting on the counter for a couple hours, I immediately, it's in a glass bottle, and it's just a little bit warmer. It's not room temperature yet, but it's warmer than you would normally drink a Coca-Cola.
Right.
And I'm immediately taken back to the summer I spent in Europe.
Huh.
I lived for a summer in France and spent some time traveling around. And immediately taken back by that room temperature Coca-Cola. It was funny. I was actually in the process of drinking it, and I had one of those memories.
Right, flashback kind of thing.
But one of those food memories of this. I am immediately thinking about being in France in 1987 during
yep.
a summer in college.
Yep.
And food really can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Food.
Mm-hmm.
We talk sometimes about smells take you back to a place. But tastes definitely do it, are the next thing besides smells that'll take you back to a place. And it was great. I felt like I was 22 years old and back in France and drinking a Coca-Cola, waiting for a train, to take me to the next cool place.
I'll tell you, one of the memories that brings me back to childhood, I was sick last year, and I was really under the weather for a couple of days at home. And I wasn't eating much, and I made myself... I don't really keep American cheese in the house, but my cousin is staying with me, and so there's some American cheese there.
Your Irish cousin eats American cheese?
Yeah.
That's odd.
Yeah, not really. and there was also some white bread, and I don't really keep white bread in the house either, and I made myself a grilled cheese sandwich in the pan,
nice.
And I was 12 years old again,
yep.
And it was great.
And it
wasn't great, but it made me feel great. it brought me right back.
It's comforting, and there's just, obviously... It when it takes you back to a good experience, it's comforting. But you see, why do people reach for those comfort foods? Why do people look for those tastes and smells? Because it takes them back to a familiar, comfortable place.
Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed is that I tend to spend a little bit more time in Catherine Lombardi now than I do in Stage Left. And probably 55-45, but...
You're the Italian boy.
Well, yeah, I spend a little bit more time there. But one of the things I realized, and I realized this, I was thinking back about it after I had that Coca-Cola. Every once in a while, I'll get to the top of stairs in Catherine Lombardi, and we have this big kind of oak door at the top of the stairs.
Yep.
And as I come through that door,
mm-hmm.
I will smell my grandmother's house.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just one of those things, and it happens, I'm going to say, every few weeks, where the smells are just right. When you walk through the door, and it's not perfume, and it's just that garlicky goodness smell that my grandmother's house had when I was a kid, and it makes me it just brings me back there and makes me feel really good.
Yeah, when I smell mothballs, I think of my grandmother's house. The same thing, different. But she's a nice lady. She used to give me candy, but the old joke is people say all the time. They say, for regular listeners, please forgive me for telling this joke again. But the old joke is. People stop me and Catherine Lombardi all the time, and they say, "Oh, your grandmother's Catherine Lombardi." I'm like, "No, my grandmother's Minnie Hackett, and the other one's Marion Riley." Mark had a French grandmother and an Italian grandmother, both great cooks. I had two Irish grandmothers. One of them didn't cook; the other one shouldn't have.
That's always one of my favorites. Whenever Francis is talking to a table and they're laughing, I realize he must be telling that
I
story.
I only have a couple of good jokes. Well, and there's another thing to go back to that Mexican Coke though. If you had, and look, people say, oh, there's no difference, you can't tell the difference between Mexican Coke and American Coke. You can, and people are willing to pay double for the Mexican Coke, so we're not all stupid, right?
You know, the other thing I'll tell you is, one of the reasons it was so different, a little bit warmer,
exactly.
You tell even more. You really see it when that soda is not icy cold.
When American soda warms up, when American Coke warms up, it's just unpleasantly sticky.
Oh, it's undrinkable.
It's sticky, sticky, sticky. And when European or Mexican Coke warms up, you know, it's not quite as good as it is when it's cold, but it's still clean. And that's, I mean, I'm sorry, but that I can do it blind. There is a difference mm-hmm. in the taste. Absolutely is a difference in the taste.
And that's one of the things I was gonna take back to. And it's funny that you noticed the exact same thing. That because that soda was a little bit warm,
you can really spot
that's really part of what took me back into the place.
Well, we're going to talk in a moment with Dale DeGroff. Dale's been on the show a number of times before. He's probably the world's foremost cocktailian or foremost expert on cocktails. And he's also a great and interesting guy. We're going to talk about cocktail trends coming up in the coming year. And also, Dale's got a show that he's taken on the road, a musical that he's taken on the show around, taken on the road around America, and also he's taken it to Europe as well, and it's a pretty cool thing. I've seen it, and we'll talk to him about that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hello there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is our old friend Dale DeGroff, king of cocktails, the man who's probably more responsible than any living person for the contemporary cocktail renaissance, and he's joined us today to talk about not only cocktails, but a new show that he's taking around the country.
Dale DeGroff, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mark and Francis. I'm delighted.
My dear friend, the only thing I like that I miss a little bit when we talk to you on the radio is whenever we meet in person, there's usually a cocktail in front of us. At least one of us.
I have my bar right here. I don't know.
I'm drinking a cup of tea. It's really anticlimactic. It's very good tea, but it's a little anticlimactic. I asked you to come on the show today to talk about a couple of things. One of them was a great piece I saw at the end of last year. You're writing now, as several of our friends are writing, for a great website that people should check out and subscribe to their email news blast, liquor.com. And you wrote, how often are you writing for those guys?
Maybe once a month.
Well, I'll tell you, I saw that there was a great piece just recently by our mutual friend Dushan Zarek of Employees Only.
Yeah,
and
I saw it.
And he wrote, it was an article on Calvados, which is, of course, an Apple branding. He wrote, Falling for the Big Apple was the title of the article, and it was terrific. But your piece at the beginning of the year, at the end of last year, was Cocktail Trends to Look For in 2012. What do you see going on in the bar world going forward, Dale?
I talked about four interesting things, but I want to start with something called Back to the Naked Classics. And what I was really trying to get to was that as things move forward in this culinary cocktail world, more and more young bartenders are doing their variations on classics. And I shudder that perhaps some of these young fellows have not actually made the classic itself.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So sometimes when I go to a bar and I order a Manhattan, I'd simply like to have a really good bourbon, some Italian vermouth, not necessarily the real spicy one, and have it just the way I used to, or maybe have a Negroni equal parts of vermouth, Campari, and gin over ice with a slice of orange without having
an infused
clay.
Why would you make a Negroni like that?
You know what
yes.
I mean? So I'm saying Back to the Naked Classics, I think you're finding a lot of bars that are actually putting original classics either on their menu or promoting them, and I think that's a nice thing.
You know, Francis and I talk about this in the food world a lot. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the molecular gastronomists in food who never learned the basics about, you know, how to make the mother sauces or
yes.
or the, you know, they're drawing from, hey, I want to do something really cool, instead of, hey, I learned this, all of this stuff, and let me draw from this warehouse of knowledge. There are molecular gastronomists who study for a long time, Grant Achatz, for instance, and then works from there and uses molecular gastronomy from there, as opposed to, hey, let me just monkey around until I find something that's neato.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes it's creativity for the sake of creativity. There's a bar called Williams and Graham that just opened in Denver, Colorado, and they have put a really nice menu, a small one, then backed up by an extensive 37 simple classics they write. And I think that's a marvelous idea.
You know, I think that if a drink is not served in a smoking pine cone, there's really no reason to serve it. There's no reason to have it. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Smoking, that's another one of the trends I was sort of forecasting, because you're seeing it. I'm seeing it in London. I'm seeing it everywhere, all around this country. And it manifests itself in two ways. Some people are actually, as chefs have been doing for salmon and a few other choice dishes, doing a little finish right before the dish is served by doing a flash smoke with a little smoke gun. And that's happening with I'm actually doing it myself with a Bloody Bull, which I think is a wonderful candidate for smoking. But, of course, there are some drinks that are really poor candidates for smoking, like a martini.
Yeah,
right. Smoked sex on the beach doesn't sound quite right.
A smoked daiquiri just doesn't.
No. You never know, though.
The way you're seeing smoke manifested in cocktails is people using a spritz or a finish or a dash or a float of a smoky scotch or a smoky mezcal, which I think is elegant and quite interesting.
You know,
like, remember the smoky martini from years ago?
Oh, yeah, yeah. With the float of scotch on the top of it.
Yeah, not real smoke, an actual float of a
right, of scotch.
A dash of scotch. Yeah. You didn't have to go all the way to Islay. You could use just a simple, decent blended scotch, and it was actually almost better than going all the way to Islay.
There's a punch that I tweeted about that I saw before the holidays that I'm gonna pop out one of these Fridays for our specialty cocktail that I can't wait to use. And he smoked the punch in the end, and how he did it was he basically he gave a couple of ways that you could smoke the punch. You could cover the punch bowl in saran wrap and use a smoking gun to like put a little smoke in there. But the way that I think we're gonna go about it is basically we're gonna smoke the glasses, and we're going to put the smoke under the glasses, bring them to the table upside down, and turn them right side up and pour the punch right in that.
That's a lovely service. Smoke. It's actually kind of exciting for the guests.
I've always preferred the cigarette method myself.
But that's illegal in restaurants in Jersey. We can't do that anymore.
You can only smoke with Camels or Lucky Strike.
You know, I wonder if we can get in trouble for smoking glasses in a restaurant.
Yeah.
I think
as long as it's not tobacco, I think we're okay. But somebody's going to complain. You know that.
I know, of course.
So, all right, so smoking you saw as another trend. We saw back to the classics as a trend. And let's go back to the classics for a moment, because there is a phenomenon here that we encounter sometimes, because, look, when we hire bartenders, sometimes we hire people with experience. But more often than not, we try to bring people into our organization who are the right people. And we can teach you how to wait tables and bartend and be a restaurant professional. In New Jersey, we find ourselves better off doing that more often than not. But what happens is when their first bartending job is behind the Catherine Lombardi bar, you know, if they come in and the first thing they learn is the 59 drinks on our menu and the 25 classics, there's a hole in their knowledge of all of these classic drinks. That there's a universe of drinks that, you know, maybe 25 years ago, every bartender didn't know how to make a drink with fresh herbs and fresh fruit, but he knew how to make a perfect Rob Roy.
Yeah.
And it was just in the lexicon of classic drinks.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of young bartenders who are kind of deft with a smoke gun, but might not know what a perfect Rob Roy is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're not really talking about lots and lots of drinks. We're talking about the 20, ultimate classic drinks, Stingers, Sidecars, Negronis, Martinis, Rob Roy. You really need to know these things. Even if somebody walks in and orders a Presbyterian, you ought to be at least aware that there is such a drink. And even if you don't know the recipe, say, you know, I know that. I just slipped my mind
and
ask, do that little trick that we bartenders do to get the recipe out of the guest, which I've done. Believe me, I'm not ashamed to do it all to this day.
Well, and you know, the other thing that young bartenders have today is, I mean, every bartender I know has a good cocktail app on his iPhone.
Sure, yeah. You can just walk away and pretend to be messing with some things and pull it up in 20 seconds, right?
So, Dale, what's
your... That's to show your lack of knowledge. But if a bartender is friendly and fun to be with and the atmosphere in the bar is great, those things don't mean anything. People would forgive a lot, you know, as long as, you know, you have that sense of fun and community and what makes us go to bars, you know. I was pretty uninformed when I started attending bar. For the first 5 years I started attending bar, I really didn't have much of a clue about what things were all about. So I was doing that a lot, asking people, but I was really friendly and I had fun at the bar. And I enjoyed being behind the bar. I enjoyed being on the other side of the bar. So I was just like telling stories and having a grand old time. And along the way, I learned how to do this.
Well, any novice in any job, I mean, this relates to everything, has holes in their knowledge. Doesn't matter if you were if you were really into it before you got into it, but before you did it professionally, you're still going to have holes in your knowledge no matter what. And the people who embrace the information that they don't have are the people who become really good at it.
You know, and there is the bartender who without the knowledge becomes defensive, and he'll and I call that that's how we make it here syndrome.
Yeah.
This is not a mite. Are you sure this is mite? Well, that's how we make it here, pal. You know, and that to me is silly, and it's just really people too proud or too embarrassed or whatever to make that leap and say, look, I just can't remember it. How do you make that again? You know, it's not that big of a deal.
the other issue, and we've discussed.
Well, the other issue, because maybe the boss hasn't set them up to make the drink in the first place, and then you're basically screwed. You know, you have to do something like find a new job.
Well, you know, another issue that comes up all the time that's really the hot topic now is whether people embrace or reject the term mixologist. And I think that mixology and bartender are two separate skills. And
well, I will tell you that I'm the guy. I mean, I've been around for a while now. I'm the guy who resurrected the term when I was at the Rain Broom in 87. And actually, I started at Aurora. But I had found the term in 19th century books, and at the time, it may be now, but I still don't think it is. It wasn't in the dictionary. It wasn't even in good dictionaries. It wasn't even in the New York Dictionary of Slang. The only place you could find it was in 19th century books, mostly books about cocktails, and the Policeman's Gazette. So I knew that the term had been used in both a complimentary and a derogatory sense, even in the 19th century, but at the Rainbow Room, because we were doing stuff that hadn't been done in a long time, I really, really wanted to draw attention to it, and it worked. The press caught on to this whole idea of master mixologist and said, what's a master mixologist? And I would, say, well, this is what we're doing, fresh and this, and real ingredients and classic recipes and blah, blah, blah. And then even when I started teaching down the road a ways, I was so frustrated with seeing bartenders that had no tools and no skills with knives or anything. I'd say, look at a chef. Look what's going on in the kitchen. Look at these guys who come right out of the CAA. They got a beautiful set of tools. They know how to use them. This is a profession, too. Get some tools. And it was just very frustrating. And so I'd say, you have to start off by being the chef of your bar. And I didn't realize that people would start calling themselves bar chefs, too.
Right,
so I got to
right.
take the rap for that, maybe. I don't know.
Well, that was you and Albert Tremor also was the first guy to put that on his card.
Albert Tremor called himself a bar chef.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to tell the bartenders to be the chef of their bar. I didn't necessarily mean that they had to call themselves bar chefs.
Well, I mean, it's pretty interesting that, we're talking to the man who brought the term mixologist into modern parlance. That's pretty powerful to affect the language so profoundly.
Yeah, I think it's been a silly kind of an argument that went on, though. It's gotten sort of a little bit out of hand. It was never meant to be that serious I certainly am proud to be a bartender.
Well, I will say astronaut is a more important word.
Yeah.
If you invented the word astronaut, I would be really impressed.
What I don't want to be is a beverage transporter, which is the term that Brian Ray used to use for bartenders when they'd sort of lost their way and nobody knew what they were doing.
Well, I think, though, that some people are... mixologist is a great thing. If you do a search on YouTube, you can find a shit bartender say, and it's sort of makes fun of the modern mixologist, and
it's very funny.
Being a mixologist, I think, and people are now rejecting that as pretentious or what I am as a bartender, and some very guys who have great mixological skills are running from the term because it's a little bit overused and it's a little bit too serious, and I think there are a lot of people who are good mixologists out there who sort of lost sight of the fact that what you must be is a bartender.
Yep.
And
yeah,
it
doesn't matter how you mix drinks if you're not a good bartender.
Well, and you can be. I mean, I'll go to the bar of someone who's not a great mixologist and drink, a gin and tonic or have a couple of beers if he's a great bartender.
Yeah.
But Mark and I have been to some bars where there were great mixologists making these well-crafted cocktails, but they were boring, serious, and yeah. they're a great mixologist, but I don't want to be at their bar. I mean,
sure. No, there is a reason, of course, to emphasize the bartender, you know, the host, the hospitality person, yeah. the friendly guy, you know, the legendary fleet-footed friendly New York bartender, you know.
you were never that fleet-footed, as I remember, Dale. You were the friendly.
Oh no, in great New York bars, you got to drink in front of you pretty quick.
Yeah, that's true.
Unless they were neighborhood bars. Neighborhood bars were famous for being sort of suspicious of newcomers, you know. But if you went to the Store Club or if you went to Charlie O's or someplace that professed to be like a great, you know, you got to drink pretty quick because you paid for it. You paid a lot of money for it, too. So believe me, that speed of service and that friendliness came with a price tag.
See, Dale, I thought you meant fleet-footed because of the women we hit on and their boyfriends chasing us.
the reason I use that term is because one of the people who taught me the ethics of the bar room and how to order, what to drink, when to drink, why, all those things, how to tip, how to be treated, how you should treat the bartender, was a guy named Ron Holland. He had an ad agency called Lois Holland Calloway, and he once wrote, I once asked him what he thought of one of my bartenders at the Rainbow Room. I won't use any names. And I thought the guy was pretty good. And he wrote me a long letter, a very thoughtful letter, and explained to me why this fellow wasn't a good bartender. And interestingly, he was one of the few bartenders I fired at the Rainbow Room because he was unable to provide hospitality and service to all the guests, you know.
Where did he fall down? To what did the letter say?
He was kind of selective in his hospitality in one way, and he was quite slow and unattentive, fussing with this and fussing with that at the expense of the guest who's sort of, you know, languishing down at the end of the bar. And that just can't be. And then eventually, Andrew eventually got fired because he got caught by a spotter or a shopper for the guests out there for the listeners who don't know what that is. It's a person who goes into your bar to make sure that checks are being made for drinks and stuff.
And you're
like
not
that.
Giving away the house.
Periodically,
You know,
and a shopper came in. It was almost not fair. There was a couple of this man was Latino, and there was a couple of Latino ladies very pretty at the bar, and he said, oh, welcome, you know, and he bought them sangria and everything. And then a Latino man came and sat down next to him. It was a spotter. And, oh, welcome, sir, you know, taste some of my sangria, and, oh, let's have this, and let's have another pitcher, and then no check for anybody, right? And the legendary Alan Lewis, you know, gruff, long-time manager called me down to the office, and he said, Dale, bring that bartender and all of his checks down to the office. I'm saying, oh, no. So I went and got another bartender from Sarah's bar and brought him out with another drawer. We took the drawer out, brought all the checks down. And, of course, Alan said, show me a check for two pitchers of sangria. And there wasn't one, right? And Alan was not, he was willing to give the guy another chance, but he said, you know what? Do you think he would have done it if it was just a white guy?
Interesting.
it's kind of a reverse
discrimination.
And Alan, we probably, if it had been two people, you know, maybe a Latino guy and then a white guy, he probably would have given the guy another chance. But what made him mad was his selective hospitality.
Was the discrimination.
Interesting. You know, it's funny, but you mentioned earlier about how sometimes bartenders can get a little. We haven't fired very many bartenders. But we had a parting of the ways with a bartender in the not too distant past, who the bar was I think the technical term is burning down. It was just the bar was full of people, and I was in the office, and the maitre d' called me up and said, Francis, I need you to come up and get behind the bar right away, because a bunch of people would walk in. So I come up, and the guy, and we pulled the bartender from the other restaurant who's back there with him, and he's like trying. He has this garnish, and he's trying to make the garnish perfect, and they're like 15 people waving in the air for him. And I was like, what are you doing? And he had gone back into the kitchen to get like a perfect flower or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like,
no sense of place or time.
Oh my God.
You said, did you notice that the person at the end of the bar was actually on fire?
Yeah, exactly.
did you notice that?
All right, so let's go back to trends. We have we have smoky things, we have classic cocktails. What else do we look for in the bar world in 2012?
There's been an interesting. And I think in 2012, you're going to see it really blossom. Is the whole idea, as we had farm to plate, you know, we're finding more and more bartenders are tending their own herb gardens just for the bar. Mm-hmm. They're as involved in the local farmers markets as the chef is. So I call it farm to, well, I don't call it. It's been called farm to glass. And, you know, one of the guys who was a pioneer in this was Adam Seeger at Nacional 27 in Chicago, who actually did have an herb garden in his bar with heat lamps and everything, and he harvested the herbs for his drinks. Which
herb
like
garden
wonderful.
In his bar does not sound good, Dale. You need to maybe rephrase that just a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yes,
not
indeed.
That kind of herb garden.
And everybody ate lots of food at that bar.
the brownies were delicious. Okay, so we have farm to glass, and what else are we looking for?
And the final thing was, as we were just discussing, there is with the cocktailian bartenders and the very culinary style cocktails, there needs, and this embraces a whole bunch of things that have to happen. There needs to be speed of service. We'd like to get these drinks into the mainstream and even into, you know, upscale multiple unit operations, you know, chain operations. And I think they the upscale ones would like to have those drinks, but nobody sees it as doable. And I think one of the basic problems is that we're making these drinks in 19th century bars. I think our bars need to be redesigned almost. The workstation, now the part that the guest interfaces with, the nice wood bar and the bar rail and the brass rail at their feet and the nice stool, that can't change. We still need the creature comforts. Everybody loves that. The American bar is a great place to be. But behind that bar, the workbench itself, there needs to be more of a garmage station kind of approach to it so that we can have all of these berries and fruits and herbs and spices and refrigerated drawers, perhaps, whatever we need to do to make it fast, to get it done, and having it right at hand. So that redesign, and I have some ideas in that area, and I'm hoping to be able to execute some of them on an upcoming job. I have a consulting job coming up.
Well, and it's not just that. You need workspaces to cut and to dice and to assemble, and it's not just a place to make a drink.
Because you don't want to be doing a lot of that during service. But yeah, indeed, there has to be interface with the kitchen. You want to be using preparations that are made in advance, and purees, and infusions,
and things that need
house-made,
and things that need refrigeration. You know, and that's the key. Because in the old bar, there were the olives, there were the maraschino cherries. Then
turned
into the maraschino cherries, and
right.
There was right.
And if you needed cream or something like that behind the bar, it was in the beer cooler, and you reached around the beer and grabbed for it.
Right.
You need to figure something out, you know, Hamilton rails or refrigerated drawers or something like that.
You know, the one of the things that I see as a trend really in the last 6-8 months or so is, and I think this ties into the farm to table is. I see in garnishes now people using more fresh flowers than I have ever seen before.
Yeah.
And I see that somewhat in cooking and pastry, but I really see it behind the bar. Pansies and roses and all sorts of cool, fresh
flowers. And those
beautiful
Sonia orchids, the purple ones.
Oh, yeah.
They cling to the rim of the glass so nicely.
Yeah, in the tiki drinks, I see them all the time, the orchids. They're really
tremendous. Well, I think part of it has to do, you know, on the culinary side of our business, let's face it. You know, you've heard me say this before when I get resistance about having fresh lemon and lime juice at the bar. I say quite often to these chain operators, I say, look, now, I know that you're serving a piece of fish in your restaurant that was caught probably in Australia, and you're cooking it in butter that came from France, and yuzu juice that came from Japan, and black sea salt that came from Hawaii, and you're telling me you can't make me a margarita with a fresh lime?
Yeah, exactly.
So what I'm getting at is these flowers and these ingredients, it's been 20 years of this culinary revolution now. They have opened up really good lines of distribution for lots and lots of great culinary round-the-world ingredients, you know, whether it be, you know, Reggiano Parmesan from Italy or yuzu from or Sonia orchids from Hawaii. They're available now all around, so you can get them on a regular and consistent basis. And I think for the bar, we need to talk to these. We with a big operation that has 400 units, if they want to go fresh year round at their bar, that's a significant decision. Can I get lemons and limes, and where can I get them from? It's gonna increase my usage by a geometric amount. Where do I get them from, and are they gonna be good? Where, I mean, you know, where's what is my supply line? Once they figure all that out, it shouldn't be a problem.
Right, it's automatic. And it, you know, a business is there to figure out systems to do things, and then you just follow through on the things that you figured out.
Sure.
Hey, listen, Dale, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back on the other side, I want to talk about the show that you're taking on the road around the country and where you're going to be so people can go see it. Can you stick around for just a little bit more?
I'd love to.
We'll be back with Dale DeGroff in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and at restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark's Press, The Restaurant Guys, speaking with Dale DeGroff.
Dale, earlier in the show, we were talking about bar trends and the things that are happening in cocktail bars and things like that, and some of the things that we can look forward to in 2012. One of the trends that I really haven't been able to get my arms around or had cocktails that I really enjoyed this way, and I'm sure that by asking you, you're going to tell me that there are things out there that I should try. But there are two trends, and one I've had some okay cocktails, but none that I love, and another I've had no cocktails that I love. And the first is cocktails made with teas, and I just haven't had cocktails that I loved that were made with teas.
Punches we've had, but not cocktails,
and beer. And I haven't had any cocktails that I enjoyed with beer yet, and all the beer heads tell me, no, you can make cocktails with beer. Help me.
Well, tea. Let's start with tea. Audrey Saunders has sort of mastered cocktails with tea, and she's been using, you know, primarily gin as a base, but it doesn't have to be gin. With her Martini, T-E-A, you know. Charlotte Voissy from Hendrick's Gin has mastered some really wonderful tea drinks. Before you make a decision, I would say try the Martini, T-E-A-N-E, that Pegu Club serves. The teas that lend themselves, now we talked about smoke as a trend in 2012. Well, Lapsang Souchong
is
quite popular in cocktails because of that smoke and richness, especially cocktails that have whiskey, et cetera, and mezcal and these kinds of ingredients.
See, but in that situation, I feel like you're not really using the tea. What you're using is the smoke of the tea.
The smoke, exactly. Well, then there's also Earl Grey, which lent it, and green tea lent itself really well to punches, fruit-driven cocktails. Green tea is probably the most mixable of all the teas. I don't know why. It just seems to work with lots of stuff, and certainly as a punch base. But I use it pretty extensively when I'm trying to figure out ways of using tea in cocktails. So, and beer. With beer, it's a little more difficult. There are a couple of beers that are popular in cocktails, chocolate stouts, really dark stouts with, you know, heavily roasted barley. And another beer is the Alambic beers. They're kind of fruity
for that sour kind of fruity, sour note that they have. I could see maybe using a little bit of that in a cocktail would help.
And I think those are probably the most popular ones to use. As far as using, like, just a simple lager, what's the point? It doesn't bring anything except effervescence. You know, it doesn't bring flavor or intensity or anything like that. So I would say stay away from those. But there are people doing really interesting things with the chocolate stouts and the Alambic beers.
Well,
and wheat beers.
I'll tell you, from my perspective, there are also people doing some really uninteresting things with beers and cocktails.
I'm sure. Like anything else, when you start using things like vinegar in your shrub or beer or tea, you damn well better know what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's got to be subtle. It's got to be you have to be very, very, you have to be a master. And you can't just throw these things together because you saw it on the internet and you think it's cool.
Well, let's talk about the story of one master mixologist, one Dale DeGroff. You invited me to see that your first performance of a show that you're taking around the country, and you've taken it internationally, haven't you?
I have. I'm having a lot of fun with it. I did it in Copenhagen at the bar show last year. The thing is called On the Town, and what it is a celebration of bar life over the last 150 years, even going back to colonial times, in stories, songs, and photographs. The stories and songs part, it's fun. The photographs are behind me on a PowerPoint, and they were my wife, Jill, who's an artist, helped me design them, and we found a lot of stock antique, very old photos and some not-so-old photos, and we put together kind of a nice photo essay. What I'm doing with this is raising money for the Museum of the American Cocktail, which makes perfect sense for the vehicle that I'm using. And it's also giving me an opportunity to tell stories and jokes that I've been dining off of for the whole 30 years I was a bartender.
and
fun stuff, and sing a couple of oddball sort of novelty tunes that play into the story. And I've got a good jazz guitar player, Joel Perry, working with me.
And you also play the guitar.
Sometimes I have to hire another guy when I'm in another part of the country and he can't make it.
But
it's
you're
about an hour and a half, and it's just plain fun.
And you're also playing the guitar. And people don't realize, I think, that you are, as so many bartenders began, you're an actor and a singer yourself.
I actually studied voice with a gentleman named Robert Murdoch, who was a voice coach in Carnegie Hall.
And for anybody who can't tell, Dale is an extraordinary storyteller. Just by sitting, listening to the show, I'm sure that anybody who didn't know Dale before knows that he's an extraordinary storyteller. But when you get Dale talking about old lore and old bars and cool places, I've been out with Dale a few times now in New York City, and all you have to do is put him in one of these settings, and the stories just come out and fill the room with the history of the place and the stories and all the cool things that have happened in each of those places. And what is amazing to me, Dale, is the number of stories you have for each of the different places that we go to.
Yeah.
It's really great.
You know, I've seen your TED lectures, which are most interesting. And
thank you.
So well done. And your TED lectures are actually mining the same rich vein that I am with On the Town, and that is the community that has grown up around these drinking and eating establishments. And that's precisely what On the Town is about. It's about the communities that have grown up around all these different sorts of bars that I've hung around in, and the ones that I haven't had the good luck to hang around in because they don't exist anymore. But how much it's meant to our way of life, and why the cocktail culture is such a intrinsic part of American life and probably our most important export.
Well, if you want to find out there to all of our listeners, if you would like to come and see Dale DeGroff and listen to the stories of the past and how the cocktail sort of came to be in an interactive event where there are actually cocktails served and Dale sings and tells stories, and you can find out where it is going to be around the country. If you're in this area, sort of in conjunction with our 20th year celebration, the celebration of our 20 years in business at Stage Left, Dale is going to be here performing On the Town on Sunday the 29th of April, and it'll happen in the afternoon. Ticket's going to be about $50. It will sell out completely, so I'd encourage you to email francis@restaurantguysradio.com to get your tickets, francis@restaurantguysradio.com. Or you can go to stageleft.com/events and you'll see some details about it. But it's going to be a fun night with a lot of old friends, I think.
Well, that's delightful. Thank you for that. And by the way, some of the funds from that $50 will be going to the nonprofit Museum of the American Cocktail, which is located in New Orleans, Louisiana. And it's quite exciting and wonderful. I'll be doing it in Los Angeles at a place called Casey's on March 11th. I'll be doing it in Philadelphia on April 22nd. And I'll be doing it in stage left on the 29th, and then in New York City at Macau Trading Company on May 14th. And you can find all the particulars at kingcocktail.com.
And we should mention that the event here is being sponsored by a wonderful company that makes one of the best piscos on the market, Pisco Portone.
Yeah.
They're sponsoring the evening here.
Johnny Schuler, I think. Last
yeah, Johnny Schuler, who's been here and made Pisco Sours with Johnny, and his Pisco is terrific, and we'll be serving some Pisco drinks. And with the price of admission, there'll be a little after party where you can have some Pisco Sours and talk with Dale.
I do think
that
maybe you left out one important detail of the event. You guys have just skipped over one tiny little detail.
I got the drinks. I got the price.
Cocktails being rolled out during the... One of the great things about a barman putting on a show...
Well, we're going to do a colonial punch to begin with. Which will be based on rum, cognac, and Pedro Jimenez sherry. We're going to do the absinthe frappe for the late 19th century era. Each era has its own cocktail, and the absinthe frappe, written, celebrated in song by Victor Herbert, and a wonderful drink, which is anisette, absinthe, and water. And it's actually much better than it sounds. I hope if you're an absinthe fan. Major Bailey, which is kind of a gin mint julep that I've jazzed up Southside style when we talk about Prohibition and the famous Prohibition saloons, most famous of which was the 21 Club. And then we're going to end up with a new millennium cocktail called, well, we're going to do the Pisco Sour for the new millennium because it's been reinvented, rediscovered, and sort of the new millennium has brought Pisco to America in a real big way.
You know, I think Pisco is a drink that is a type of liquor that many people are unfamiliar with and think it's kind of a new thing in North America, anyway, in the United States. That is, the Pisco Sour is the most popular cocktail in all of Latin America. Is that correct?
And it arguably may be one of the first distilled spirits made in the New World, because it was made in what was called the Vice Royalty of Peru, which stretched from Central America to the tip of South America along the west coast. And the Vice Royalty of Peru was a Spanish colony, and they brought lots and lots of the sweet grapes that were famous around Spain, like the Pedro Jimenez, like the Muscat grapes, like the Madeira grapes. And they did very, very well in those transversal valleys where the rivers ran down to the Pacific Ocean. And lots of clones developed, and they had a roaring wine trade with Spain until the king put the kibosh on it because local growers in Spain complained. So these guys were, even with the trip back to Spain, it was still, they could still undersell the guys in Spain, which is to tell you how well these grapes did and how... Well, they were stuck without being able to make wine anymore, so they decided, even in the as early as the 17th century, they decided to make spirits.
And that was Pisco.
And of course, they weren't aging spirits in those days, so it was unaged spirits. And they didn't even ship it in barrels. There wasn't a whole lot of wood around. They shipped it in clay vessels called piscus. And ship captains stopping at the deep water port of Pisco in the 1840s and 50s, traveling from New York or from anywhere on the eastern seaboard to San Francisco, started a little sort of cottage trade, you know, because San Francisco was happy to have anything that had alcohol in it.
If only you knew a little bit more about the history of cocktails, Bill. You might be a really interesting guy.
So
there's a lot of useless knowledge if I could only... just shackle it to something useful.
Well, like this show. Well, no, and so Pisco was actually, there's a historical precedent for Pisco being really popular in San Francisco a long time ago.
Totally. And I think I've rediscovered the button punch, and maybe we'll make it that night after the show.
The button punch after the show. We're not even going to tell you what's in it. You've got to come to the show to figure that one out.
Of course, that's because I don't know what's in it.
So, Dale, thanks for coming on our show. We look forward to seeing you in New Brunswick on the 29th.
Dale,
it's
always great having you here.
I'm so excited about the show, and I'm delighted to be with you guys for the afternoon, even if we can't reach out and clink glasses together.
We will on the 29th. Plenty of Pisco to go around. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. That I always want to have a drink after I get talking to Dale. I really want to have a drink. It's too early in the day, but I want to go have a drink.
It is being in a room with Dale, and I know that a bunch of our listeners have been, but I also obviously a lot of our listeners have never gotten a chance to be in a room with Dale. He's one of those people that lights up the room. You know who he is the second he walks in the door because everybody is automatically attracted to him. He's the guy in the middle telling stories that everybody's listening to. You know, we talked earlier about going out to bars and places and cool places in New York City with Dale. There is no cooler place to go with Dale than 21 Club.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's one of those places that you can tell Dale has this real affinity towards.
I've been there forever, and
it's
Dale's
been
a part
forever,
of his history for
and, you know,
30
years. It's one of those places that Dale enjoys being in, and one of the reasons Dale enjoys being in it is because of all the history there.
Yeah.
And it's great to be there and be like, oh, Dale's like, oh, that's the table that he sat in, and that's the table that every Tuesday night this guy sat in. It's so much fun. And so interesting to listen to Dale talk about that kind of history. And it's always more fun when you have a cocktail in your hand.
Yeah.
Which is why I love the way he's doing the show.
Well, and if you go to 21, you really need to read up on it a little before you go and ask the waiter or the maitre d' about the history of it. Because when they find out you're interested in it, they're going to leave you alone. They're a classy place. And if you just want to go and have a nice meal, they'll leave you alone. But if you ask them about their history and about Prohibition, how long it's been there, if you start asking questions, they're going to start answering them, and the answers are going to be pretty darn interesting.
It's fascinating. It is a fascinating place to go and have dinner and live in history. It just is.
You know, the other place that's like that is P.J. Clark's.
There absolutely.
There are a couple of P.J. Clark's in Manhattan now, and it is a bit of a chain, but the original P.J. Clark's is really, again, it's you know, living in history, and they have some great bartenders there as well.
Some really good bartenders. Actually, one of them was featured in the Times about a couple of years ago, a guy that's always at the front door.
A little crowded for them to give you walk you through the whole history unless you're there on a Sunday afternoon. It's a little more hubbub there, but it's also a lot more affordable, so we can check that one out. But I hope that you come and join us on the 29th of April, 2012, to hear Dale DeGroff sing and talk about cocktails. We're only going to be able to take about 50, 60 people. We're doing it in the restaurant with a little cocktail party following, and if you're coming from far away, let us know and we'll try and arrange for a hotel room for you at the Heldrich Hotel right across the street. It's really terrific, and you can do that by giving me an email, francis@restaurantguysradio.com, and me or one of our staff will definitely take care of you. I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. We are the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
And you're listening to us on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com.